Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia? Solartopia, Solartopia.
We bit that apple and the garden was lost. And so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
But oh, yeah.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.
Yeah, we started to burn too many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing, as always, every week with us, with the magnificent Pete Seeger and David Burns, who wrote the lyrics for that song, We Are Back. That song won a Grammy on the Tomorrow's Children album from Appleseed Records. We have two amazing guests today. David Braun, are you with us?
I am. Good afternoon.
Wonderful. Talking to us from Northern California. Northern California. I am in Southern California. You're in Northern California. You are a great, great expert and activist, one of the best speakers I've ever heard on global warming and the need to get to Solartopia. We're going to talk with you. And Joel Siegel, you with us?
Yeah. Hey, Brother Harvey, how are you?
Okay. Brother Joel and I, David, have been working a lot together on Puerto Rico. We did some of the first shows on the disaster in Puerto Rico, which was being widely ignored by the public. And David, you're going to chime in with us in a minute, but we have some breaking news here that's quite astounding, actually. I want to be the first to announce that in the last couple of days, Puerto Rico is the first major, we can't call it a state, it should be a state, but the first major political unit, first island in the United States to go 100% solar. Now, it was not meant to happen that way, but Puerto Rico backed into being Solartopia. And what happened was, and you can read this in the New York Times and elsewhere, that it's really a lesson in karma. And the New York Times story points out that the Puerto Rican Power Authority, Puerto Rican Electric Power Authority, PREPA, had been announcing earlier in the week that most of the power, virtually all the power, had been restored in Puerto Rico. And they were just crowing about this, that all but about, I guess, 9%. It was still about 50,000 people still didn't have power in Puerto Rico, but they were saying that they got the job basically done. The Hurricane Maria, and before that, Irma, had wiped out the power grid and left the island dark. And they were saying, well, we got pretty much everybody. Of course, that didn't count to 50,000, still blocked out. But nonetheless, within hours after them making this announcement, some guy with a steam shovel or a backhoe or something took out a transmission station and blacked out the whole island. Except, now this is what's amazing to me. And this is Joel here, and David, I want your comment on this. None of the news stories mention the fact that in the wake of the hurricane, Elon Musk and other people poured in a whole bunch of solar panels. Now, there was one major solar array at a farm in a greenhouse set up somewhere on the island. And it was temporarily put out, but was back in power the next day. It was the only major power array in all of Puerto Rico immediately after the storm. Now, in the wake of the storm, Elon Musk came in with a whole bunch of solar panels, and especially at the Children's Hospital in San Juan. And Tesla and Elon Musk totally solarized this hospital. It was the only hospital on the island with completely reliable power. Now, all the stories about this blackout, which I believe happened on Tuesday, say that the island went totally dark. none of the stories mention the fact that the Children's Hospital, which was solarized in Puerto Rico, never went dark. Neither did that farm with the solar panels, nor all the other places that were solarized on the island by Elon Musk. And even today's story in the New York Times, which is talking about the blackout here, it has one fragment of a sentence that says those places with microgrids did not go dark. You know, you would think that the New York Times, of all people, covering this massive blackout, would have a moment in this very long story to point out that the Children's Hospital in Puerto Rico and all the other places in Puerto Rico with solar did not go dark. And it's, in fact, except for I'm sure there are a few gas and kerosene-powered generators operating on the island, but those places, the whole island was basically whoever had power had it on solar. And the mayor of San Juan, Joel, what is her name?
Carmen Cruz.
Carmen Cruz is quite progressive and really a fireball. I mean, she really took on Trump. Tweeted out that she was she had solar, she had light when the rest of the island was dark because she had a solar light. Now, Joel, what can you tell us now about what's going on in Puerto Rico with the solar? And then, David, I'll ask you to chime in.
I think it's a brilliant paradigm that this is the first time that we could say it's a 51st state, really, Puerto Rico.
Well,
we had 100% clean energy. We had Solartopia. But, you know, you have 3.5 million people who are on the island. And a lot of the electricity was, you know, being turned back on. And as you said, this it was actually it was a tower, right? Because in Puerto Rico, most of the power is generated from the south, and then there's these, you know, a lot of telephone lines and telephone poles, and one dude knocked one over. There's the blackout, and I think it's something like 1.3 million customers don't have any power. And the microgrids, if you look up what a microgrid is, it's really an independent way to generate power. And it's usually done by solar, right, or wind. So I think New York Times, I don't know why they didn't put solar, but it does show empirically that it was a microgrid, whether it was, I'm sure it was solar, that survived. And then Elon Musk tweeted, you know, the only places that were not impacted by the blackout was where they had batteries, i.e. that's where they store, right, the backup power from the solar panels. So it just shows you that, you know, if we're going to have a Puerto Rico that's going to be energy independent, clean, and you know, hurricane resistant, they have to go 100% solar, because otherwise the same thing is going to happen, because the hurricane season is about to enter Puerto Rico again. What's going to happen again if it's Michael Mann, the great climate scientist, is saying could be Category 6? You know, Category 5 hurricanes. Look what it did to Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands. What happens now? But if you have microgrids, you know, then that's what Puerto Rico needs to do. Go to 100% solar.
Well, it's quite amazing. David Brown, you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, and you are one of the great advocates for fighting global warming. Are there solar arrays in the Bay Area that would survive an earthquake or a storm like the one that knocked out all the power in Puerto Rico?
Well, I mean, there certainly is a lot of rooftop solar here. And I think that, one of our main solutions is we just need to be covering all available surfaces with solar panels. We have places like Puerto Rico or places like California, we have such abundant solar resources. When you have a country like Germany that has the solar resources of a, you know, in terms of its latitude, of a place like Canada, and then you look at these places that like California or like Puerto Rico that get so much more sunlight, it just doesn't make sense that a place like Germany is powering a very, very high percentage of its energy supply from solar, and not to be doing that here, or even in a place like Puerto Rico. I do know a couple of friends that have worked with Elon Musk that were part of the crew that went down there, and they were down there within a few days afterwards, getting folks online and I think helping to bring that hospital back online. And so I'm glad to know these folks and be a part of this community that's trying to bring us into the renewable energy world and away from this, you know, crazy centralized, you know, fossil fuel. I mean, it's preposterous that everyone loses power, 1.3 million people or whatever it is, you know, just because of one error.
It's shocking, isn't it?
That's a broken system.
this is 1.3 million people. One guy with a backhoe knocks over a tower that takes out a transmission station. All these people lose power. And then the only places now, this is Elon Musk tweeted out, Tesla batteries are currently live and delivering power at 662 locations in Puerto Rico. And he sent over 1,000 batteries. Those are the people who have power. Not a single major story in the media. They all just completely, this is from Tesla's own website, and, you know. But I assume that, and there's a picture here online, you can go to it online, teslarati.com, of people, maybe a couple of your friends, David, putting solar panels onto a mountaintop, actually, in the deep outback in Puerto Rico. But not a single major story that I saw anywhere in the corporate media that reported that Puerto Rico is blacked out had the word solar in it. And Elon Musk is saying here that there are over 1,000 Tesla batteries at 662 locations in Puerto Rico. He doesn't mention the hospital, but we have every reason to believe that the hospital came right through. They solarized that hospital. Joel, wasn't it within 2 weeks they got it up?
Yeah, that's what I recall.
Harvey, could you repeat that question one more time? I'm sorry.
That's all right. Wasn't it within 2 weeks that they got the Children's Hospital?
Yeah.
Within 2 weeks after the hurricane, the Children's Hospital was back up.
2 weeks. You know, it just shows you the power of solar. And it's an honor to meet your colleague, by the way. I was in Puerto Rico, and when you go down there, first thing that hits you is the heat, the humidity. And it's just unbelievably perfect area for there to be solar. And what Puerto Rico needs, though, is the funding from our Congress or from maybe the United Nations to rebuild it so that it's solartopia. But if it doesn't, that's why I'm working on legislation with Representative Ted Lieu to solarize the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. It's not just myself. I'm working with a lot of different organizations and scientists inside and outside of Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. But that's the only way they're going to survive. But they don't have the funding to do that because they're in debt, and our wonderful president, you know, certainly not going to help them. He might throw some more paper towels at the people down there, show how much he cares about them. But
I'm sure
there needs to be a citizens movement, really, both in Puerto Rico and then outside of Puerto Rico. We have to support people like Carmen Cruz and, you know, make sure that they got the funding to solarize the island. That's the only way it's going to happen.
Well, of course, Puerto Rico is being, you know, raped and pillaged now. It's a disaster. Capitalism is. Naomi Klein did a beautiful story coming out of Puerto Rico about what's going on down there. This is a Trump's people view this as an opportunity to turn Puerto Rico into a Hong Kong or a Singapore, offshore, low taxes for corporations, the whole deal. I'm looking here at the last paragraph of the story from Tesla. Tesla aims to supply 40% of the island's energy with solar and battery solutions. Cost of the project would be about $9.58 billion. But if it's financed, because Puerto Rico has, you know, been stuck with such a bad credit rating, not their fault, by the way. So about $9.5 billion. Now, let me put that into context, David and Joel. Trump was just approached by the First Energy Corporation of Akron, and they want to bail out 4 atomic reactors plus about 70 coal burners.
you know, it's almost impossible to say this without throwing something, but they want to bail out 70 coal burners and four or more atomic reactors in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and through the Midwest there. And they want Trump to use an emergency, it's called a 202, an emergency piece of legislation to allow the gouging of ratepayers in the Midwest for about $8 billion a year to sustain economically unsustainable coal and nuke burners for the indeterminate future. Alongside that, Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, has approved and pushed through the regulatory process, or people are challenging this in court, thank God, a $7.6 billion bailout for four reactors in upstate New York. Now, lay those numbers, $8 billion a year, in the Midwest, $7.6 billion one-time shot in New York State, against the $9.5 billion it would take to 40% solarize Puerto Rico, which has just lost power for the second time. David, you're in the rate area of Pacific Gas and Electric. You are paying for Diablo Canyon nuclear plant. Now, what would happen to the Bay Area if Diablo and all the other fossil burners went out in, God forbid, a major storm or an earthquake?
Well, I mean, you're touching on this is exactly what the conversation needs to be about right now. You know, I mean, we're at a point in history where we recognize that create better infrastructure with better technology. It's an investment into our future, into the future generations. Who we are their ancestors, right? We are the ones that are going to be either creating a world that will be livable for them or not. You know, we have this opportunity to passively harness sun and wind. And, you know, we have wave power here in California. We have tidal power in California. And we can invest in these things and build out these microgrids that will not be demolished, or we can continue to dig up fossil fuels from the ground. And, of course, this is something that I deal with day in and day out that has extremely toxic effects on our communities, because it's no longer just pockets of oil that we're drilling into. We're now drilling into these shale formations that have the oil and gas distributed through them, and we're having to increasingly use really invasive technologies like fracking, like acid matrix fracking, like acidizing, where they're taking hydrofluoric acid and hydrochloric acid and shoving it into the ground at extremely high pressures to be able to release this oil and gas. And of course, it's a never-ending search for this. It's not like a solar panel where you put it in and it just keeps giving. You have to keep digging these toxic fossil fuels out of the ground with these increasingly toxic methods that we know are now poisoning our communities. So it's a real no-brainer, Harvey. I mean, that's the problem, is that we're living in this world that we have the solutions, but sadly we have institutions that are, our decisions are being made by economies or economics that are not in the best interest of the people. And nowhere do we see that better than in Puerto Rico or here in California or in other places where we have a few people that are benefiting, the folks that run the Chevron or, the different oil industry interests. They are basically going to be out of business if their business model doesn't continue. And so they're basically fighting with all of their lives to maintain this this fossil fuel empire, which is not only poisoning communities, but it's also poisoning the planet and poisoning our future well-being. I think this is the heart of the discussion, and I wish more people were concerned about it and taking a role in trying to get us into a better transition, into a better place.
beautifully said, David. I'm going to come back to you and talk to you about specifics in California in a minute. Joel Sewell, we have a dichotomy in Puerto Rico, as we do in California and elsewhere. You have a mayor in San Juan, Carmen de la Cruz, a fantastically powerful woman, who is advocating for solar and wants a decentralized grid. And at the same time, you have a governor who wants to privatize the public utility, doesn't seem to have said much about solar, seems to stick with the old paradigm. Give us a rundown, if you can, of the politics of the coming energy situation in Puerto Rico, because it's really an allegory for the rest of this California. And I'll get to Dave, back to David in a minute.
It's actually analogous to probably even the fight that we're having here in North Carolina, where Duke Energy wants to build the Atlantic Coast Pipeline with frack gas, which is, you know, releases methane, which is much more lethal than CO2. And, but, you know, we the people want clean energy, but this one utility company, well, you have Duke Power, and then you have Dominion in Virginia. They are like, hey, the, you know, we don't really care about climate change or the survival of the human species. We need to make money off cheap gas. And it's the same thing, I believe, in Puerto Rico. So you have a governor who he's quite paradoxical because on the one hand, he's traveling to the United States. He's forming PACs so that the Puerto Rican citizens can take out voters who didn't want to, you know, who elected a politician who didn't want to rebuild Puerto Rico. But he's not saying anything about rebuilding it so that it is clean. So there's an organization called Corazon Latino. I'm a proud board member of it. We're trying to be like a lobbyist for the clean energy movement in Puerto Rico. And with Carmen Cruz, we're in contact, or, you know, we're in contact with her to the best of our availability. But unless there is a movement here in the United States that's got money, and then working with those in Puerto Rico who don't really have a lot of money to put pressure on their governor, you know, it's going to be very difficult to deal with a governor who is aligned with the idea of rebuilding the old energy grid. Here's the good news. The good news is that if Puerto Rico's clean energy, you know, use went way up and Congress, we had, let's say we had, we take back the House and the Senate, right? And of course the White House could be more difficult. You could pass legislation that overrides PREPA. I've been meeting with the Hispanic state legislators, and that's one of the things they said that you got to put in this new bill to solarize Puerto Rico. And I was PREPA. They have to use microgrids and solar and clean energy. And then you have to have funding for the groups who are there on the island who just don't have the political power that they need to out-organize. You know, it's hard to leave in the house when it's dark, and it's hard to organize when you don't have food, and it's hard to organize when you're, you know, your state's been destroyed. So that's why we got to rebuild Puerto Rico. By rebuilding Puerto Rico's infrastructure, we could also rebuild their clean energy movement. You know, I mean, there has to be a discussion among the big greens, like Sierra Club, they're down there, and then progressives about, you know, like the Poor People's Campaign. Dr. William Barber is very interested in Puerto Rico. And we have to work together, and we can, you know, it's a democracy. We can do that. But that's the kind of discussion that we need to start having in the progressive, you know, green community. How do we help rebuild Puerto Rico so that's clean, it's, and it's solartopia, and we haven't had that conversation yet. We're starting it, though. We just need a lot more help, you know. Especially
I think Bernie Sanders did raise the issue at some point of, you know, rebuilding the grid. I think you and I, Joel, conspired on some of the first articles that that went out there, and I did have the satisfaction of you telling me that one of my radio shows led to someone making a major donation down there that to do a microgrid.
Yes, that's right. Thank you.
So the paradigm, I mean, in a certain sense, Puerto Rico is the perfect opportunity to shift the paradigm, as is, to a certain extent, California. I mean, David, you and I as Californians can take a certain pride in knowing that Tesla was really the first one down there, as best I can tell, the first corporation to go down there with a major solar panel infusion that has to have certainly a tangible impact. I'd love to meet your friends who helped put those panels up. That must have been an amazing experience for them. And how are we moving in California? Joel's talked a bit about the politics of Puerto Rico. How are we moving in California to solarize the state?
Well, you know, we're definitely putting solutions in place. So that's the good news. And we have a governor who is good at talking about the solutions. Sadly, though, you know, and just to point out, you know, Joel, I agree with you that it would be good for us to win back the House and change the equation. But as a person who was on the Democratic Platform Committee last year or 2 years ago in 2016 on behalf of the Sanders campaign, we're sadly seeing the Democratic Party is not the Democratic Party that I grew up with. These are not, you know, it's no longer necessarily like kind of the good guys and then the corporate, you know, warmongers. Sadly, is it kind of that was how I recall growing up and the vision that I had in my mind of who the Democratic Party was. And, you know, I found myself at odds creating policy for the platform with somebody who is a consultant for the fracking industry and was working, quote unquote, for the environment on behalf of the Clinton campaign. Now, of course, without a doubt, I would much rather be pushing, you know, Hillary Rodham Clinton in the White House right now to do more on climate change than to have a president that we're trying to even convince that it exists. Sadly, I wish that the lines were that clearly divided when it came to you know, the Democrats and the Republicans. And nowhere is this actually more clear than here in California. We have studies that are on the books that say that fracking is likely to contaminate our groundwater, especially here in California, because we have unique geology. But here with a Democratic supermajority, you know, running the Assembly, the Senate, the governor, it's been 3 years since we've had recommendations by state scientists that said you shouldn't issue permits if you can't prove that this is safe. And meanwhile, permits keep getting issued. You know, you have a guy like Trump that's talking about opening up the coast to more oil drilling. But Jerry Brown himself, you know, and of course, Jerry Brown vocally opposes that. Everybody gets out and opposes that. But Jerry Brown himself has issued 238 permits for offshore drilling in California's waters in the past 7 years. And so we're living at a time where the oil industry, you know, they're not picking winners or losers. They're investing in everybody. But what that means is we're all the losers because we get in there thinking that our Dems are our friends. And sadly, that's no longer the case. You know, the oil industry spent $36 million in the 2016 legislative session in lobbying in the state of California alone. And that buys a lot of policy. You know, we have a terrible cap and trade bill that was passed here last year that Jerry Brown's touting as being some sort of great solution that took away the abilities for communities to regulate emissions in their own communities. It was just a horrible bill, market-based mechanism solution for climate change. We have urban oil drilling, which our scientists have identified as being toxic because they're using hundreds of thousands of pounds of toxic chemicals. And we know this to be true. We know that in LA, in urban areas, that on average every year, they're using about 7 million pounds of hydrochloric acid in oil operations, about 3 million pounds of hydrofluoric acid. That's what they etch glass with. Extremely toxic. These are air toxins. about 40,000 pounds of ethyl benzene is being used in L.A. County on a yearly basis. So our scientists have identified that these things are all very, very toxic, made very, very clear recommendations to protect our communities. I mean, forget the climate for a moment, right? We're just talking about individuals, predominantly people of color, living in low-income neighborhoods near these oil operations. Our scientists said you should have human health buffer zones around these oil operations. And here we are 3 years later after our scientists made these recommendations in democratically controlled state of California, and those protections haven't been implemented. So we're definitely
living in a
very difficult time, I think, right now, because we know these solutions, but meanwhile, the kind of the old guard is still in control of the ship.
Joel.
Yeah,
very well spoken, Davis. You're one of the most articulate guys I've ever met. And, you know, as a Southern Californian, I live in a county, L.A. County, 10 million people here. This place is an oil patch. I mean, there's drilling, there's fracking, there's, you know, all the worst kind of stuff right next to people's houses. People in L.A. think the general view is that the air is bad here because of the cars, and they certainly don't help, but this place is an oil field. And Joel, I'm sure that, you know, people now, they're still talking in Puerto Rico. The average age of the power plants down there is 40 years. And here you've had an object lesson in the insanities of a fossil-based centralized grid. And the corporate people are just barreling right ahead and want to restore the old grid the way it was. Joel Siegel, what do you got on there?
Yeah, I want to respond to Brother David. I worked for Congressman Connors for 13 years, and almost 14, 1999 to 2013. I was a senior legislative assistant. I don't disagree with the premise that the Democrats, in terms of, you know, thinking that they're the be-all, end-all to change our energy policy, but I do have a different paradigm. When I went there, I wanted to do single-payer universal health care. And after getting about 1,000 organizations together, we did get to a point where single-payer became the number one issue for the Democrats in Congress. And what I learned was the Republicans, it's like going up against a brick wall on universal health care. But if there's constituent pressure, and I would know because, you know, if you work in a congressional office for 13 years, you know how the Democrats work. If there's consistent applied pressure by the constituents, on the staffers and the members, you can change their behavior on energy. But left alone, I agree with David, they will go with the status quo. A perfect example was Governor Cooper, who I'm a friend of, here in North Carolina, said no to offshore drilling, but yes to the most lethal pipeline, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. Well, now we progressive Democrats are putting tremendous amount of pressure on the governor. We're meeting with the staff, the attorney general, because we're trying to flip them. But, you know, there's still something missing in the dialogue here, not necessarily our dialogue, but, and that's, where is the progressive, you know, climate movement? Why aren't we more unified? Why are we still so siloed? I know Russell Green, who helped, I don't know if he was the same person that drafted the platform with you, but on energy policy, it was the most progressive platform ever on clean energy. And we were stunned when we saw it. I live in North Carolina. So you did have a major impact on the Democratic Party. The problem was we didn't see what was going to happen because Trump got elected. But I'll close by saying that, you know, unless we really have a discussion about power and unity and how are we going to have a fusion 100% clean energy movement where we include green jobs and clean energy and 100% you know, clean energy homes for the homeless, we're going to have the same conversation. But these siloed organizations that get the foundation grants, they're not doing their job good enough. Thank God for them. But why aren't we unified like those students in Parkland, like Martin King's civil rights movement? why does the clean energy movement, why is it so siloed? There's way more of us than there are of those who support dirty fossil fuels, but why aren't we unified, whether it's Puerto Rico or here? That's the question I'd like to ask Brother Dave.
Well, David, you know, you mentioned Russell Green. The last time I saw David was at Russell Green's house, and that's why I invited him onto the show. And, you know, I will say, in blowing our own horn here, the Solartopia concept is meant to unify not only all the energy activism, you know, towards a goal of 100% renewable without fossil fuels or nuclear power. You know, I've been a nuclear guy all these years, but also to unify social movements. I mean, it's not going to do us any good to have a solarized, well, it will. I mean, it'll help us to have a 100% solarized economy and still have 55,000 homeless people in LA and the kind of horrible imperial incursions we have. It's all of a piece, but you make a good point. David, how are we doing unifying the energy movement in California?
Well, so I just to jump back for a second. So yes, that was Russell and I helped pass that amendment, and you can look on the Climate Mobilization's website to see the video of when that moment happened. We were told that we were going to be opposed on our amendment to call for a climate mobilization, and that was an amendment that Russell had written, and he opened it, and I gave a bit of a speech there to try and pass it, and we pushed past the opposition and did get that. But, you know, on the other hand, we didn't get an inflation adjustment for Social Security, which a lot of folks felt like was a no-brainer, and we didn't get single-payer health care, which I know that the good folks from National Nurses United were very, very disappointed about. So we got some things done there, but maybe not perhaps all the things that we would have liked to get done. Honestly, to tell you the truth, I'm a guy that I came into doing this work environmentally through fracking in New York State. And we won. We won a ban in New York State against fracking, pushing Governor Andrew Cuomo, who you mentioned him earlier. And, you know, he wasn't an easy guy to move. It took a lot for us to do that. And it was a very powerful grassroots campaign that we ran that was based in science, but also very strong advocacy in really pushing him and following him and making sure that we were, had a very strong presence in his life at his events, making sure that he basically never forgot that we were there. But, you know, we had a lot of people that told us at more mainstream environmental organizations that we would never keep the fracking industry out of New York, that we were naive and how foolish we were to think we could keep the frackers out of New York. But in fact, we won, and they were wrong. And I honestly think that that's a bit of the problem here in California, is that we have a lot of kind of middle of the road in terms of like moderate environmental organizations who see that we just have to deal with toxic wastewater pits percolating their chemicals into our water supply, and that we have to deal with that through trying to regulate. I mean, it's really foolish what we're trying to deal with. I mean, on average, we know nationally about 400,000 pounds of chemicals go into each and every frack job. And we still have organizations, and God love them. You know, I know there's lots of great people that work at the NRDC, but, you know, they won't come out for a ban on fracking. They somehow feel like, well, this is something that we need to fit into our energy supply. And perhaps it is because today the United States is using a lot of natural gas or oil. But at a certain point, you have to take a stand against things. And, serious well casing failures and some of the other mechanical issues that exist with fracking or other forms of extraction can't be remediated. They can't be fixed. And I think the reason that we lose is, you know, I would love to see the Sierra Club come out with a position of a national ban on fracking. To my knowledge, I don't believe they have. Certainly they do work in communities, but I think that there's a problem that One, nonprofits have to make money, and they have to get their money from somewhere. And so I think that there's a bit of a business angle that happens within the nonprofit industrial complex. So I think that sometimes some of these organizations, and, you know, without naming names, but I understand that people need to pay their staff and they need to keep the lights on. And I think that sometimes what happens is that the priorities become fundraising rather than actually stopping some of these dangerous practices that we've been charged with. And I think there's an immense responsibility that goes with trying to protect the environment. And perhaps sometimes folks don't prioritize that responsibility as being job number one. I think it sometimes is maybe job number two or job number three. And I think that's too bad. So I think that we need to get out of the clicktivism that exists. I think people, you know, signing petitions, and I think we need to get more people engaged in having conversations. You know, we've been running a campaign called Oil Money Out. And it was basically because there's a practice currently in the state of California where they are taking wastewater from an oil field and they are selling that wastewater without filtering it, no reverse osmosis, nothing of the sort. And they're utilizing that oil wastewater to irrigate crops in the Central Valley. There are currently four water districts that are doing this irrigation. And it's like organic table grapes are being watered with this water. Carrots, mandarins, pomegranates, pomegranate juice, wine is being made. And it doesn't affect organic certification because it's not actually a growing practice. It's the water. And so we tried to introduce legislation around that a couple of years ago into the legislature. And we couldn't even get someone, a legislator, a senator or an assembly person, to pick up the bill because they didn't want to take on the oil industry. They didn't want to take on big oil and they didn't want to take on big ag. Well, they're utilizing those same chemicals that I mentioned that they're utilizing in LA. Well, they're utilizing those same chemicals in the Central Valley. And so here we have this potential huge health crisis because they're utilizing chemically laden water on our food supply, and here you have no legislature that's willing to stand up to the most, you know, one of the most powerful industries in the state to object to this. So it's really we're at a crossroads of, the entrenched power structure and who wants to take it on. Now, I would love to see some of the larger environmental organizations take this on in a little more concerted way. But sadly, we've seen them only stepping away from these issues. I don't know why these groups don't do more that have more power. But it would sure be nice to see them pick up some of these issues and make a bigger deal out of it, because they found like benzene in this water. They have found acetone in this water. But meanwhile, the practice continues, and there's just basically a review panel that's looking at it that doesn't really have any teeth to actually do anything about this. And that's basically what's being done. So sadly, I think that there's the people aren't really following the ball, and the environmental movement could use better alignment. That said, let me just quickly say that 750 organizations just delivered a letter to Jerry Brown because he is hosting a Global Climate Action Summit this September 12th and 13th in San Francisco. And ahead of that climate summit, 750 organizations, of which my organization, Roots Keeper, was one, delivered a letter to Jerry Brown saying, you know, if you want us to support your climate summit, you really need to stop issuing permits and stop supporting these dangerous practices like urban oil drilling, which you said that you would basically take action as the science dictated, but you haven't really done. If you want us to support you, Jerry Brown, we really need to see you step up as a climate leader and start rolling back some of the oil extraction that's happening in the most dangerous places here in the state. So there was a lot of alignment around that. Again, sadly, we saw the Sierra Club sit that one out, and we saw the NRDC sit that one out. But there were some great organizations that we were able to partner with, like Greenpeace, you know, like the Center for Biological Diversity. There are a lot of really good players. And, you know, even our friends at Sierra Club are trying to work on their, you know, to try and push Jerry Brown from an inside position. And so you can't ever really criticize anybody for trying to make a difference in the way that they feel is right. But what I do know is that we are losing when it comes to urban oil drilling with fracking and with other things. And you would think with all the groups in the room, we should be winning and doing better. So I wish I could put my finger on it entirely, but I would say it probably has to do with money.
Yeah, David Brown, your press release was from the San Francisco Bay Area. What's your organization? How do people get a hold of you?
You can find us at Rootskeeper. It's rootskeeper.org, and you can just email us at info@rootskeeper. Want to give a plug to protectcafood.org. Again, that's protectcafood.org. That's the Protect California Food Coalition that we're a part of. And then also the oilmoneyout.com. That's another campaign that we're running to try and get oil money out of state politics. It's oilmoneyout.com.
Great. So Joel Siegel, thank you for that, Dave. It was beautifully spoken. Joel Siegel, can you parallel what David has just told about his experiences fighting in California with what's going on in Puerto Rico?
Yes. The main difference, though, is I wish I could listen to David, by the way, all day. He's one of the most intelligent, fascinating spokespersons I've ever heard on this issue, by the way. I'm so glad I get a chance to just be on the show with them. The difference is where there's hundreds of millions of dollars with our green organizations and even just progressive social justice organizations, we could unify in a national conference and create one big umbrella. We've tried doing that twice already. It's called the Justice Action Mobilization Network. In fact, Russell Green was at one time our former co-chair. And, you know, that's what needs to happen in Puerto Rico. They need to have one unified kind of a green movement. But the problem in Puerto Rico is the activists and the organizers down there are desperately short of funding. I work with them, you know, on a weekly basis. And what they have to do just to get a grant, you know, for example, to solarize farms, you know, compared to what the big green organizations here who've got these gigantic bank accounts, I think what needs to happen is our major green organizations need to start cutting some checks, more checks, to the local activists in Puerto Rico. And I'll close by saying that every movement that I've been a part of that was successful, didn't matter if it was SANE, FREEZE, anti-apartheid, divestment from South Africa, universal health care movement, it wasn't the major organizations that ended up leading the movement. It was really activists from cities and towns across the country who made a concerted decision to win and to be serious, and then they got some funding. But we're gonna have to like bring in the faith community, progressive business community, and unify. That's all there is to it. And there's, you know, over 300 million people in this country, and you got Puerto Rico with 3.4 million. We have to be in solidarity with them and get our checkbooks like these real estate brokers are doing in Newport, California, because of your show, where they're going to solarize mountains, towns, and small neighborhoods. We're actually raising the money. We need $20,000 to just solarize, you know, a community. So we're going to need the private sector to also step up. We can't do that. We need a unified movement, not only in America. We need it globally. And Michael Mann said we have less than 3 years to survive climate change. We've got to be well on our way in our transition. The other problem is that we lack diversity. Thank God for the white people who are in the movement, but where are all the other races? We've got to bring as many of the different races, and it's got to be more intersectional, you know, physicians and teachers. But we're going to get there. We have no choice. There's no planet B, but I'm just glad that I had a chance to talk about Puerto Rico, and also, you know, get to, for the first time, hear Dave.
Okay, there's one thing I want to jump in on. Joel Siegel, you're in North Carolina. How do people get a hold of you? The people that called from my show that offered you the money, how did they get a hold of you?
I literally gave my number. It's Joel Siegel at 571-344-1518. My email is Joel, J-O-E-L, dot R, dot Siegel, S-E-G-A-L, at gmail.com. I'm with the North Carolina Climate Solutions Coalition. I'm the executive director at NorthCarolinaClimateSolutions.org. And please call me or email me. You know, I'm just one person trying to do God's work and save our planet. But, you know, everybody needs, we all just need to work together as 100% clean energy extended family.
Okay, great. And Dave, we'll get to talk to you again tonight at KPFK in LA. We have just a couple minutes left, and I think you guys both did beautiful jobs of summarizing. I can't let this go by. Joel, you've been helping your mother to survive in Miami, and you came across an astonishing shortage of morphine and Dilaudid. Can you explain why the climate crisis in Puerto Rico has killed the morphine supply at hospitals all over the country? I mean, this just blew me away. We only have a minute or two left. Can you explain this real quick?
Yeah, there's a shortage now. Actually, there's no Dilaudid in any hospital across the country because the majority of our painkillers that are morphine-based or narcotics-based were made in Puerto Rico, and they were destroyed in the hurricane. And the Army Corps of Engineers and FEMA, they didn't build them back up. So when my mother was writhing in pain in Fort Lauderdale, we asked for morphine, and they said, there is no morphine. So we asked for Dilaudid. They said, there is no Dilaudid. And we said, what about other hospitals? They said, no hospitals in South Florida had morphine or Dilaudid. And then I found out today, no Dilaudid in any hospital because it doesn't exist because it's made in Puerto Rico. That's why our fossil fuels that we burn here and create warmer waters in the Atlantic and the Pacific and create these fierce hurricanes, destroy islands, directly impact us. And we don't think that we're interrelated. We are inextricably related together as a family. And now, you know, as a result of that hurricane, we don't have morphine for patients who are in serious pain and Dilaudid. And, you know, it was a nightmare. That's all I can tell you. It's a nightmare.
It's astounding.
Watch my mother suffer because she didn't have morphine and Dilaudid. They did give her a painkiller, but you know, I mean, how many thousands of people right now are suffering because they don't have morphine and Dilaudid? This is an unbelievable tragedy. It needs to be the front page of the New York Times, Washington Post. It's nowhere other than you, Harvey. You know, no one else has broken the story.
I'm floored by this. For tax purposes, basically, the production of morphine and Dilaudid has been centralized in Puerto Rico.
Correct. And many banks.
It's astounding. And in comes a hurricane out of the blue, two hurricanes, really, Irma and then Marie. And suddenly all the hospitals in the United States are short or out of these vital painkillers. It's a staggering reality. I have not read about this anywhere. I hadn't heard of it until you told me because you're in South Florida taking care of your mother.
But what's even scarier, Harvey, is there's no plan to get the morphine and the Dilaudid back online. The Trump administration, see, HHS should be doing something about this. The Army Corps of Engineers, FEMA, they should be down there right now rebuilding those facilities or building them here or getting them from other countries. But because of tax breaks of the big corporations, they've moved the multinationals in America. They went to Puerto Rico and they're called mini bags too. And this is a real crisis. And what is the Trump administration doing? And what's the Republican Congress doing? It's nothing. So there's still, you know, they could be without drugs for weeks or months, just like the Puerto Ricans could be without electricity, all because we have a fossil fuel dominated economy and we're using the wrong energy. So when people say, what does Puerto Rico have to do with me? I'll tell you what it has to do with you. There may be hundreds of thousands of people who don't have painkillers like morphine and Dilaudid because of these hurricanes, which were caused from, you know, climate change.
That is the ultimate expression of the law of unintended consequences. How a hurricane in Florida, I mean, in the Caribbean, can wipe out power
in an island off the coast, and for tax purposes, that's where the painkillers are. And suddenly, all the hospitals in the United States are without these vital components for medical care. It's staggering. It's the ultimate lesson in interconnection. David Braun and Joel Siegel, you guys have been great. You guys should know each other, by the way.
Joel, I'd love to know you. You're friends of friends, and clearly you're doing good work. So look forward to it's an honor to be on the show with you, but look forward to getting connected with you.
And, Joel, you're my brother from another mother, if you know Russell.
That's right, Joel.
I love him. So I can't wait to meet you.
Right on.
And thank you, Crew in New York, for doing this. It just gets stranger and stranger. And I got to respond, to a certain extent, we're all suffering from the fact that in the mid-1980s, the Clintons and the corporate Democrats basically formed the Democratic Leadership Council and sold out the Democratic Party to Goldman Sachs. And Clinton got himself elected and then made a complete mess of the situation. We're all paying for that now. I mean, here in California, we see the California Democratic Party, which runs this state, lock, stock, and barrel. They run it as much as the Democratic Party ran Mississippi in the era of Jim Crow, and we can't get anywhere. The great Jerry Brown, the leader of the renewable energy movement in many ways in the 60s or one and 70s, one of them is, he keeps Diablo Canyon going. We got our work cut out for us. Thank you, guys. Thank you so much, Crew in New York. We'll see you next week. Take care.
Thank you.
Solartopia.
Take care, guys.
We got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world.
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.